Hey everybody, it's Bina 007 back again for another movie review, but this week it's not going to be in 10 minutes, and that's because I'm reviewing Michael Cimino's seminal 1980, well I won't say hit, Heaven's Gate. This is a movie that has such a checkered production history and was so notorious on release that it was for years labelled the worst movie ever made and sort of consigned to the dump of unfashionable films. But it's been lovingly restored and it's going to be re-released in the UK on August 2nd. And I was lucky enough to see a new copy of this film. Once again, I'm convinced that this is really one of the best films ever made. Despite what everybody tells you, it's certainly for me one of the best new Hollywood movies. So I'm going to do a long discussion of Heaven's Gate today. It is going to be full of spoilers, but I'm hoping that the movie is so part of the Western mythos and indeed history that that's not going to detract from anyone's enjoyment of the film. But just be warned that I'm going to go through pretty much scene by scene and discuss my response to the film. And I think this is, I mean, it comes across as a little bit indulgent, but this is a film that's had so many pages of awful stuff written about it that those of us who do want to defend it and embrace it need to give ourselves the room to undo some of that damage. Heaven's Gate is based on a real story in US history called the Johnson County War, which took place in 1892 in Wyoming. And to me, this is just such a fascinating part of US history because it shows the brutality and violence that comes with settlement. You know, that you have waves of immigrants who are well established and are protective of their position and financial interests, battling against a newer wave of immigrants. And you know that so much a part of the American mythos, this phrase on the Statue of Liberty, bring me your huddled masses and I will, you know, give them shelter and succor. And yet this movie is all about what happens to those huddled masses when they get their strip of paper saying they own some land. And it's a brutal, horrifying story. So what basically happened in the Johnson County War is that you had settled Wyoming cattle breeders who were in association together and were very fearful of and prejudiced towards the latest wave of immigrants coming from Eastern Europe and Russia. And those immigrants typically were naturalized and did have land rights, but it had been such hard conditions that they were at the margin pushed to steal cattle to stop starving. And so the cattlemen basically clubbed together and under the guise of protecting their interests and protecting their stock were basically just going to butcher these people. And they of course did not have warrants because these are extrajudicial killings. They just hired a bunch of mercenaries and told them to get to it and had an infamous death list. But of course these guys are the powers that be, and it is a matter of some controversy how far the genuine organs of state were in support of this. So that's the mythic story number one. The mythic story number two is surrounding the new Hollywood era of the 1970s, when you had this new wave of anarchic directors such as Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese. I guess you'd put in there Schrader and Billy Friedkin, who had grown up maybe on the European art house movement and wanted to do things differently. They wanted to make meaningful films, but they were taking on the studio system at the time. These were not independent filmmakers. It was all about how you could work within the rules of the game to get the money that you needed and the editorial control that you needed. And of course they had their early triumphs, all of them. But by the time you get to when this movie's being made, it's the end of the 70s, and they have been deified by the studios and by the populace. And most of them have way too much money. They're binging on drugs. They are tyrannical, egomaniacal, all of them trying to outdo each other with the profundity of their vision and just how much stock they could shoot on a particular film. I kind of feel that Heaven's Gate gets unfairly tarred with the label of having killed that era of New Hollywood. Because actually, if you look at the production history of Apocalypse Now or Raging Bull, those were both semi-disasters. I mean, way over budget, egomaniacal, coked-up directors. And those movies equally could have been the John Carters of their time, basically just going completely tits up and taking the studio down with them. Now, unfortunately for Michael Cimino, it was Heaven's Gate that did that. He shot the movie, I think he had a budget originally of something like $11 million. And the studio, because he'd just won the Oscars for The Deer Hunter, they were so beholden to him that they gave him contractual permission to spend as much money as he needed to make the original 1979 release date. So of course this movie went way over budget because this guy was an absolute perfectionist and a tyrannical monster. And so he would have sets ripped down and rebuilt because they weren't quite right. And he would have irrigation systems put under lawns so that they would look vivid green enough against the blood he was going to throw there. But anyway, I would assert that Heaven's Gate was not unique. It was maybe just the biggest example of what was going on at the time. And yes, it was a problematic production. It went massively over budget. And yes, Zimino hoarded the editing and took way too long and went into the editing studio with 220 hours of printed film and came out with a cut that was like 500 minutes long. Understandably, the studio was not impressed and made him cut it down. Eventually, he releases this 219-minute cut, which bombs in New York. So he cuts it down to sort of just under 115 minutes. It still bombs. And today we have a wonderfully digitally restored 219-minute director's cut that he has supervised, that is his vision of the film. So I guess my issue is, why did this movie bomb when it came out? And I think that by the time you get to 1980, a lot of the film critics and the studios and the PR machines have just gotten sick and tired of these egomaniacal directors, these auteurs who think they're so self-important. The critics had their knives out for this movie. I'm not sure they reviewed the film. I think they came to it with a moral superiority towards the director. And actually, if you come to the movie as I did, I think I first saw this on probably like a chopped down version on TV in like the late 80s. If you come to it fresh without that baggage and knowing everything that I've just told you, so maybe I shouldn't have perpetuated the myth, what you realise is that this is an absolutely stunning, stunning movie. And I contend one of the best of New Hollywood, which is why I'm spending so much time talking about it today, hopefully not to an empty room. So I would urge you to go and watch it again. I mean, I think it's really indicative that I posted a tweet where I said, just watched it, Over the Moon, one of the seminal works. And a really good friend of mine from the States, who is one of the best educated, most literate, most culturally aware people I know, said, oh, is it worth seeing, despite ... all the stories? And I was like, wow, if one of the most culturally sophisticated guys I know has already slammed this movie in his head as not being worth seeing, something's really gone horribly wrong with the balance between critic and film. You know, critics, and you know, as in an amateur way, I'm one of them. Hopefully we give you some insight as to what a movie is trying to do and whether it's successful in that. But if the critical consensus is preventing people from going into a movie with an open mind, my word, we've gotten it the wrong way around completely. Mini rant over. Let's now get to Heaven's Gate. And once again, I would say that this is going to be a spoiler-filled discussion and appreciation of the film. It's not going to be a straightforward 10-minute review. I don't know how to talk about this movie that briefly. And I want to make you understand why I'm in love with this film, and it's not just as a sort of knee-jerk, contrarian view. So the movie, I think, is long, but it's very structured. And structured in a very clear way. It's a very linear narrative, and it falls, I think, into four very clear acts with a prologue and epilogue. The prologue takes place over half an hour, and it's set in Harvard in 1870. And we have two very good friends, Averill, played by Chris Christopherson, and Billy Irvin, played by John Hurt, and they're graduating. And this 30-minute section has so much energy. The camera is moving so fluidly that we're wrapped up in the triumphalism and the ebullience of these young men that have all the world before them. They're graduating Harvard at the height of America's industrial boom, and the world is quite literally theirs to take over. And you can feel that, you can sense that joy and that energy and that wondrous laughter at their own wit and intelligence. And yet something's already a little bit wrong and off kilter as we walk into their graduating hall with all these adoring, beautiful girls, the room's pullulating with adoration. You have a very old Joseph Cotton from Citizen Kane and The Third Man, playing this sort of college reverend who says, you know, men, you have a duty to civilize the uncivilized. But then we switch to Billy, the John Hurt character, who's already kind of slightly drunken, but a showman and great fun. And he's been picked to make the valedictory speech. And despite all the hilarity and clever wordsmanship and, you know, all the entertainment factor, when you look at the content of what Billy says, it's that it's very hard to change the status quo. And that is a key message that's going to come back to haunt us at the rest as this film unwinds. So after the Sheldonian speech, we move on to the college lawn, where there's a wonderful extended waltz scene, which again is full of kinetic camera work and energy and the beauty of these girls and the bravery of these boys, all set to the Blue Danube. And you know, life is summer and wonderful. And yet the violence is creeping in under the surface, and it's not entirely clear why, but as the sun sets, some kind of kerfuffle breaks out, maybe a town versus gown thing. You see Billy, his face bloodied from a punch, and he turns to a quite understanding Avril and says, "It'll never be this good again. This is as good as it gets." And my God, I find that so poignant and so true. How many of us look back to those final days of college when it's always summer and always beautiful and everything is hopeful and every part of the world is offering you choices and doors to open and thinks, my God, it'll never be that good again. I guess in my case, helped a little bit by the fact that although this movie's set in Harvard, it's actually filmed in my alma mater. Not entirely sure why. So now it's 20 years later, and we move into Act One of this film with perhaps the most stunning small scene of any film of its kind, where we have a poor immigrant settler. He's butchering a cow that he's apparently stolen to feed his poor huddled family. And there are white sheets flapping in the wind, and through the sheet we see the shadow of a man in a fedora with a gun, and the rifle comes up and he shoots the man dead through the sheet. We never see his face. And it's just stunning expressionist film. I mean, right now I can picture it vividly. And that frames what's going to happen for the rest of the movie. We then switch to Avril, who's now 20 years older, a very world-weary marshal, riding into town on a steam train. And the first-class carriage is empty apart from him. And yet above the carriage are all these immigrants huddled, clinging to the top of that train with all their belongings. And that is what we get from these scenes in town. The noise is just incredible. You can't hear the dialogue, practically. And at first I thought, my God, is this a problem with the sound mix? But no. Michael Cimino is making a point about the energy and anarchy and brutality of an industrial boomtown. And what's going on is that you're hearing industry grind its wheel, and you're seeing these poor immigrants really just left to sink or swim. Poor kids begging, a poor station master, the only guy who's going to give him a few pennies, and already cluing Avril in, reluctantly, that something's wrong, that the stockmen, the elite farmers, are very worried about these poor starving masses stealing their cattle and are going to take brutal action. And I have to say, this scene, again, it's not just the sound design that's impressive, the production design. I'm not sure if this was the set that Cimino had sort of ripped down and rebuilt, but my God, this set deserves an Oscar on its own. You feel so tangibly inside of the Industrial Revolution. I've never seen anything like it. And the way in which that steam train roars into town, dust and steam and brutal energy, is like something out of a Turner painting. What I also love is that Cimino makes this kind of, it's not a jump cut, but it feels like it, from that train scene to the elite, hushed, luxurious wood panel club where the stockmen are gathering. And it's almost as though the rich can afford the luxury of silence and to think. And in this very civilized wood panel surroundings is where Karen, played by Sam Waterston, the entitled WASP elite, are discussing how they're going to create a death list with 125 men on it and have them killed by mercenaries. As simple as that, they are going to take back the West. And I love the kind of disingenuous language that they use. Instead of saying, look, we've got a bunch of property, these guys are nicking it, we're just going to enforce our property rights, they frame it in this grandiose language about these guys coming from the East are anarchists and socialists, and we have to enforce and uphold the laws of these United States. If we fail, the flag fails. Unbelievable. And the only voice of dissent is our old friend Billy Irvin, who has turned from a sort of charming roguish drunk into really a depressed nihilistic drunk in a pattern that I feel is tragic and, you know, one of the worst depictions, one of the best, I guess, depictions of a drunk since Sebastian Flight and Brideshead Revisited. So he gives Avril the full details of what's going to happen. And they part ways, and Avril moves back to Johnson County to warn his fellow men, even though he is, of course, of the class of the stockmen. So he's acting against his class financial interests, so to say. Now, as we move into Act 2 of this film in Johnson County, we see a different kind of ebullience and exuberance and joie de vivre that matches and echoes that waltz on the college lawn at Harvard. And most of it is overseen by a character called John Bridges, played by a very young Jeff Bridges. And he is running a sort of emporium of cockfighting, drinking, gambling, and perhaps somewhat improbably, a roller skating rink that comes complete with old-time band called Heaven's Gate. And as much as Avril wants to warn everyone about the coming war, it just seems so kind of completely fantastical that nobody listens to him. And it's for two sort of contradictory reasons. First of all, they think it's too fantastical that guys would come into town with a death list. But secondly, because it's almost like, yeah, that's always the story. The rich are always after us. So why do anything different now? So there's a classic line from Jeff Bridges' character where he says, "It's getting dangerous to be poor in this country." And Avril replies, "It always was." And that, I think, speaks to, in a way, like one of the frustrations going through this movie is, why does nobody leave? Why does nobody leave? And here you have it. Plus, you know, until these guys come, they're having a jolly good time. And the vehicle through which we see this good time is through Avril's relationship with Ella, who's played by a very young Isabelle Huppert. She is a beautiful brothel madam, who is, by the way, taking payment in advance always in cash or indeed in the rustled cattle, which makes her also a target for the stockmen. Avril buys her this wonderful horse and carriage, and there's this brilliant scene where she's riding into town to show it off, and it's all filmed in POV shots and very fast, and you feel the exhilaration and the craziness of this wild ride. And they go into town and they go to Heaven's Gate, and they go to the roller rink, and again there's this wonderful dance scene to match the Blue Danube scene where they're all on roller skates, and it's one of the best uses of music and a fluid camera that I've ever seen. And you see that as poor as these people are and as hard as their life is, there is a sense of community and a sense of joy and a sense of coming together to celebrate and to be as one. And you can see why they would choose not to believe Avril and not to leave. Of course, for Ella, the decision is rather complicated because if Avril had asked her to leave with him as his wife, she would have gone. But he's not offering that. And it becomes clear when we see him later in his rooming house that he still has a picture of his old college sweetheart, so his relationship to her is rather equivocal, whereas she does very much love him. But at the same time, she's in love with the mercenary, Nate Champion, played by Christopher Walken. And he does want to marry her. He doesn't offer her as grand a life, but he offers her safety and protection of a sort in his little cottage that he's so proud to have decorated with wallpaper. But it's really just pictures cut out of newspapers. Again, this act of the film is just full of stunning images, just very perfectly framed shots that will always stick with me. One of them, when a very drunken Avril is deposited back in his lodgings and he's taken through a rooming house that is just so full of people and hammocks swung here and there. It extends side to side, but also vertically. It's just as if everyone's huddled in together. There's another very beautiful and poignant scene where we've got a team of old women pulling a plowshare until one of them falls down from fatigue. And finally, just one of the most beautiful and poignant scenes of the whole movie. A lot of this movie actually plays out without much dialogue. It's all about the expression on people's faces. And there's a scene where Nate has asked Ella to come to his cottage. And you can tell he's sort of trying to persuade her that they could make a life together. And he pulls out a chair for her at his table. And there's this desperate air of excitement as to, is Ella going to sit down? And in doing so, confer him her favor. And neither of them is quite sure. Even Ella, up until the point when she does it. And then the sort of nervous energy when she does, his kind of boyish smile in relief. It's just absolutely touching. But of course, that can't last forever in such a film. And as we enter the third hour of Heaven's Gate, we move into Act 3, and the war is starting. And tragically, it's this young train steward who was so sympathetic to the immigrants who's the first to be shot. The way in which that first kill is shot is so poignant. I mean, there's a ground level camera shot looking up at the dead man, red on green of the grass, up to this big vast sky. And you realise just how beautiful this landscape is. This really should be God's own country. It should be heaven. And it's being turned into this hellish massacre. And then suddenly things build up and build up very, very quickly indeed. We switch to Averill, stuck in Heaven's Gate with all the townsfolk who've gathered up, reading them the names that are on the death list. And they realise it's men, it's women, it's practically the whole town. We switch back to Ella. She's being gang raped by these nasty men who know they have the okay. Okay, Averill does manage to come in and get them off her, but it's too late, she's been raped. But even then she won't leave. It's just like there's this complete mental block on realizing how serious this is. And of course they're both very stubborn and she won't leave until he tells her he's going to marry him, which he won't. I think what's especially relevant to our time about this act is the reaction of the townsfolk who are holed up in Heaven's Gate. They see themselves as the real contributors to society, the people who want to make something of the land and take it beyond just cattle pastures, who want to live and build and work hard. And they characterise the stockmen as Eastern speculators, which I think is quite similar to our sort of post-global financial crisis era, where you have people who would see themselves as part of the manufacturing base of the developed world and people who make things, as opposed to the bankers who just seem to sort of move abstract pieces of paper around an electronic screen and produce nothing but just take the cream off the top. There's also something very modern and very aggressively modern about this idea that the system is rigged. So when they're having their debate in Heaven's Gate, one of them says, "Your hopes are exaggerated. In the end, they get it all anyway." In other words, there's nothing you can do about it, so why not try and negotiate with them? And I think that is, isn't it, some of the rage that infects the Occupy movement and maybe even the Tea Party. The idea that the system has been rigged, it's been going on like this forever, it benefits a certain class and we have to go outside of the system to get our fair share, and even that's almost a hopeless task. As we move into the fourth act of the film, we basically have just amped up all of this pain and suffering into the true massacre, the true war of Johnson County. Poor Nate Jampion, who has discovered some kind of nobility and honour after the rape of Ella, finally turns on his masters and says, "I don't understand what you're doing, I don't understand it, I don't respect it." And for his pains, he's burnt out of his cottage, and it's so poignant when we see his pathetic newspaper wallpaper burn up, and shot in a shootout that is as tragic and visually impressive as anything from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And meanwhile, the townsfolk are still holed up in Heaven's Gate. As they come out, they're shot down. Whoever survives holds up for the night. And although Averill has threatened many times to leave them and has been summarily fired, he can't quite bring himself to abandon them, and he tries to give them some Roman tactics about how to defend themselves while going on the attack and buys them a few minutes, but ultimately it's a futile game because eventually, in the midst of all this carnage and dust and the wagons overturned and men being butchered, the US Army does turn up to try and intervene, and we think, oh my God, are they going to restore order? Are they going to save the townsfolk? But no, they're just there to enforce the rights of the stockmen. Everybody go home, there's nothing else to see here. The dead are dead, the arrested will be arrested. Averill crawls off. And in perhaps the most haunting shot of the film, there's this one woman who just blows her brains out. It's just absolutely horrifying. And I have to give the director, Michael Cimino, so much credit for not sensationalizing that shot. It's very quiet, very effective. But it's unflinching. He doesn't turn away. It doesn't feel gratuitous, it just feels absolutely right. And so as we leave Johnson County, we have this one glimmer of hope that maybe Averill and Ella will leave Ella in bridal white, but of course that's absurd. Nothing romantic survives in this environment, and even poor Billy Irvin, with his highfalutin language and quotations, boldly declares, "All flesh is dust," He has no resistance to give to this movement, just as Nate Champion giving a final FU to the president does nothing. No one can stop the juggernaut. So in the final 15 or so minutes of this 3.5 hour movie, we move into the epilogue and we see an aged Avril. He survived, he's escaped, technically speaking. And he's in a luxurious suit on a luxurious yacht with a luxurious woman. It's the childhood sweetheart, now aged and desiccated. And the poor man just looks like he's absolutely suffocating in chintz and peaches and roses and lace and fur. There's no dialogue spoken, but you can just feel his absolute alienation and withered pain as he looks at this woman who's nothing like his beloved Ella, and with whom he can communicate nothing of what he has seen and experienced. So, in the final analysis, what does this movie give us? It's utterly bleak, nihilistic. You know, if Easy Rider ends on the note with one of the hippies saying, "We blew it," and everyone argues about what that really means. But Heaven's Gate gives us the message that you didn't blow it. You never had the chance to blow it because the rules of the game were already blown. It just kept reminding me of the Leonard Cohen song, "Everybody Knows." Everybody knows the dice are loaded. And what this film is telling you is that if you still roll with your fingers crossed, you're a fool. It's perhaps an ironic message coming from the guy who made the movie that he wanted to make with the budget he needed, despite the studio system and the studio rules. I mean, he really did get away with it and took the studio down with him, but I guess they exacted their revenge ultimately, because he did end up like the desiccated Avril, never really making another movie of note or completing his vision or early promise. As I said many times before, I think this movie is full of stunning imagery, beautifully framed shots, but also this wonderful moving camera that communicates the energy and hope and ebullience of community life. I've never seen a movie use music this well and communicate the joy of shared music so well. It's beautifully acted. So much is said without dialogue, just with expressions and how characters are with each other. And I just do not understand how people can watch this film and not respond to it deeply. I guess that's the wonder of cinema. It's subjective, we all respond to different things. But I do hope that now that enough time has passed after the initial hype and craziness around its release, that people can just watch it as it is and just take it for what it is, which I believe is one of the most impactful and intelligent and boldly realised westerns in cinema history. So I'm not sure if you've managed to bear with me for all of this podcast, but if so, I wish you, dear listener, a very good day, and hopefully have given you some reason, even if you're not persuaded by my argument, some reason to try and give this movie a chance. Because I promise you that even if you don't love it as much as I do, there will be visuals or lines of dialogue, hopefully, that will stay with you and profoundly affect how you see that period of American history and indeed our own. So with that, thank you for listening. Okay, so here we go with the checkered release history of Heaven's Gate. It originally opened in November 1980 in a 219-minute cut with an interval. It was withdrawn from release really quickly and then was brought back to cinemas in a much shorter 147-minute cut that again played nationwide but bombed. Since then, it has been lovingly restored by a combination of MGM overseen by Michael Cimino. And what they've done is they couldn't use the original negative because obviously that was cut down for the shorter release. But luckily they had an old YSM, but luckily they had an old YCM three color negative. So what they've done is a 2K scan of each of those three stats. So what they've done is a 2K digital scan of each of those three strands and then recombined them and then done some work to take out any scratches and whatnot. And what we now have is a really beautifully restored film that is vivid in colour, and all this has been done under the supervision of Cimino, so we know that this is the sort of definitive version of what he wants us to see. The length of the final film is 216 minutes, and it's pretty much the same as his original 219-minute director's cut, except that it doesn't have the interval on one or two other long shots. This new cut has been rated 15 in the UK for strong violence, sexualized nudity, and language. There's also one scene of unsimulated animal cruelty, notably in the cockfight, that was cut from the UK version. In the USA, the film has been rated R. It's going to be back on release in the UK on the 2nd of August at the BFI South Bank and selected cinemas nationwide. And I would really encourage you to try and see it on whichever is the biggest screen you can find, because this is a movie that stands and falls on its beautiful, lush visuals, and it's absolutely worth that effort of trying to seek it out on a big screen.